At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, are you ready? Because this is going to be an economic week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today the 25th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is going to be an economic humdinger this week is. Wednesday, Jay Powell and the gang at the Federal Reserve are going to let us know how much they are going to bump interest rates this time. Conventional wisdom says 0.75 percentage point. Friday is going to bring us June numbers on personal income and personal spending. Also Friday, PCE, personal consumption expenditures, the Fed's preferred measure of inflation. And Thursday, we get what some consider the most important piece of economic data out there, gross domestic product. All of this is happening, of course, as the word recession is on everybody's lips. And while GDP can give us some clues about how the economy's doing, there is also a whole lot it cannot tell us. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us started.
There's one thing this week's GDP report will not tell us.
GDP alone is not how you determine a recession.
That's Austin Clements at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. He says the National Bureau of Economic Research, which determines when recessions begin and end, takes a much broader view of the economy. And right now, the picture is cloudy.
We have high inflation, but we also have a very strong job market. We have, it looks like, negative GDP growth, but also still pretty robust consumer spending.
That strong job market is a huge factor in whether people feel comfortable spending. And not only has the economy been adding jobs, there are still over 11.25 million unfilled positions out there. Economist Megan Green is a senior fellow at Brown University.
So there's a lot of room for people to jump back into work, and none of that is showing up in the headline figures for GDP.
GDP can also be distorted by volatile parts of the economy. For instance, businesses built up record amounts of inventories over the last two quarters. Sarah House, senior economist at Wells Fargo, says it's unlikely that companies will keep building inventories at that pace.
And so even as we see companies continue to replenish their stocks, the fact that they're doing so at a slower pace equates to a drag in terms of the overall rate at which output is expanding.
Bottom line, it's possible that Thursday's GDP report will show the economy's contracting. But if that happens, take it with a huge grain of salt. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
About that grain of salt, Justin was talking about the National Bureau of Economic Research a minute ago and how they're the ones who call what is and isn't a recession. It is technically the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the NBER that does that. I just like to get that out there so you all know about it. All right, elsewhere in macroeconomic news today, a survey from the National Association for Business Economics about, among other things, what the everlasting global supply chain gobstopper is doing to inflation. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
The July survey of corporate economists showed essentially no improvement from 3 months earlier. A record number of firms reported material shortages, and most are passing higher costs for inputs onto their customers. Supply chains remain volatile and unpredictable. Ken Simonson, chief economist at Associated General Contractors of America, says in construction, lumber and steel prices have eased off recent highs, but
gypsum wallboard, they're going up. Concrete and glass.
It's been chaotic.
That's Lewis Black, CEO of Toronto-based mining company Almonty Industries, the biggest global supplier of tungsten outside of China. He says ever since the pandemic hit, shipping space has been scarce and prices have soared.
Planning is really out the window. If you're lucky, if you're having a good day, you get some space. And if you're not, you don't.
One sector where supply chains have improved a little is the auto industry. Analyst Garrett Nelson at CFRA Research says semiconductor shortages are still holding up production, but there are more new cars on dealer lots now. The main reason?
The combination of growing recessionary fears, rising interest rates, and new vehicle prices that are still hitting a record high has really led to some demand destruction.
Meaning fewer people are buying new cars. With less pressure to roll new vehicles off the assembly lines, automakers, shippers, and dealers have more chance to catch up. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this first day of a five-star economic week. A little up, a little down. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. With climate legislation, well, charitably speaking, mostly dead in the Senate, President Biden has said he's going to be taking more executive action to do something about the planet getting hotter, including supporting more offshore wind projects in the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico. The administration's already approved the first two big commercial offshore wind projects, and there are at least 10 more in the pipeline. Construction has already started on the first one. Vineyard Wind is going to be more than 35 miles off the coast of Massachusetts. It'll have 62 turbines to start with and promises to generate enough energy to power 400,000 homes and businesses. But also not for nothing, it's going to create about 3,600 jobs. What kinds of jobs, though, and who's going to get them? Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on that one.
On a recent Tuesday at Massachusetts Maritime Academy on Cape Cod, a dozen people are learning how to climb a wind turbine and evacuate from one in case of emergency.
Okay. Sit down in your harness, step yourself over the opening, and we'll bump you through the opening when you're ready.
This safety training class is required for anyone who wants to work in offshore wind. Today is all about working at heights, something Granny Bartelis has never done.
Like, I just learned how to put a harness on today, so.
Bartelis is an apprentice electrician. She's here with a handful of people from her union. The makeshift turbine they're training on is about 24 feet high. And before doing her first evacuation,
I was scared, but then actually doing it, I was like, this is not that bad.
But the actual wind turbines Bartelis might be going up on would be 300 or 400 feet high and more than 30 miles out in the ocean.
It is seem kind of daunting when they're talking about heights and huge deep sea.
But Bartelis is intrigued, and her union has been encouraging anyone who's even a little interested to take this course to get certified to work offshore. Because after years of delays, construction is now underway on Vineyard Wind, and there are going to be lots of jobs to fill.
There's the development jobs, getting the project permitted, going through
engineering. Jennifer Cullen manages labor relations and workforce development for Vineyard Wind.
The wind farm. There's the construction jobs. There are the long-term operation and maintenance jobs. And then there will be jobs created within the supply chain.
The goal, Cullen says, is to hire as many local people as possible. But the reality is, right now,
it's a huge challenge.
Offshore wind is a new industry in the U.S., and there aren't many people yet who have the necessary skills and experience.
The training between where our workforce's current skill sets are and where they need to be in order to construct offshore wind, there's a gap there that we're working to address.
Vineyard Wind is working with local labor unions, colleges and universities, and the state of Massachusetts, which is investing millions of dollars in workforce training.
to identify where those training and educational gaps are
and figure out how to fill them. A lot of that work is still in the early stages because until about a year ago, it wasn't clear if or when Vineyard Wind or any other offshore wind projects would actually get the go-ahead.
We've been looking at this for about 15 years, knowing that this was a huge opportunity.
Jennifer Menard does economic and business development at nearby Bristol Community College.
But as you can imagine, we only wanted to really offer this until there were jobs available for our students.
Now that jobs are available, the college is investing a lot more in classes and even degree programs, and in marketing and outreach to let people know about all the different careers that exist or will soon exist locally in the industry. There's still a long way to go on that front. Even students taking the safety training class at Mass Maritime say they don't have many details yet about what the jobs will actually be, where they might be, or when they'll be hiring. But a lot of them are excited anyway, like Brian Rowan.
The wind turbines, I know it's going to be a huge thing for maybe the next 20 years. So if I could finish my career for those next 20 years, that's what I want to do.
Rowan is an iron worker, and he's hoping to get a job assembling turbines.
I know heights don't scare me. I have no problem being on the ocean for a month. I feel like there's a ton of money in it, you know, and I can't wait.
Sean Dyer is excited, too. He's an electrician from southeastern Massachusetts.
This is a huge project. It will bring a lot of work to this area.
Which doesn't always have a lot of steady long-term work. And he says it'd be something new, wiring turbines.
This is like kind of a little radical, going out in the ocean trying to wire stuff.
Dyer's still not entirely sure how he feels about going miles offshore to work for a couple of weeks at a time. But he figures it'll be steady work that'll pay well, and
somebody's going to build it.
Hopefully, he says, he'll be a part of it. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Last month, when the Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade, abortion access became illegal or deeply uncertain, anyway, in almost half the country. And along with that, abortion care training has become incredibly difficult for medical students and residents to get. There are, of course, medical professionals who choose not to perform abortions and so don't necessarily need the training. But for those who do, they will now have to go to great lengths to get that part of their medical education. And as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explained, that is going to have implications for other kinds of OBGYN care.
Even before Roe was overturned, there was this big gap in abortion training for med students and residents. Medical Students for Choice is one of several programs across the country that helps connect them with clinics. And since the Supreme Court ruling, Executive Director Pamela Merritt has been busy working the phones.
I'm doing okay. I'm hanging in there. So I am helping out with the intake conversations and
the work has always been difficult, sending students hours away from where they live and coordinating transportation and lodging. But now the jobs become even harder. On this call, she's setting up training for a student who lives in Texas.
Please keep in mind that, and you probably know this as well as anybody, that with the ruling, there are an increased demand on existing legal clinics.
Med schools aren't required to teach abortion training, and though residency programs are required to for accreditation, quality and intensity of training vary. One estimate shows that nearly 40% of residency programs do not offer routine access to abortion training. And Merritt says that was before the Supreme Court decision. Now,
we had to tell 50 med students that they weren't going to be able to receive in-clinic training for this year, simply because the clinics are overwhelmed and, you know, universities are scrambling to try and save their residency programs.
Just like how people in some states have had to travel to clinics hours away or across state lines to get an abortion, aspiring doctors have had to do the same. And now they'll have to travel further.
It really could be like flying across the country.
Kristen Simonson is with the Ryan Residency Training Program, which helps hospitals implement OBGYN curricula. She says it's possible that students and residents in states limiting abortions or outlawing them altogether may not be able to learn how to perform them at all, because lawmakers could restrict abortion training at public hospitals and schools that are funded by state governments.
If their residents are considered state employees, if faculty are considered state employees, but then they're teaching medical students, you know, I think there's a lot of questions, a lot of questions with no answers.
Limited training could result in underprepared or unprepared doctors, especially in states where abortion is restricted to rare circumstances, like when a mother's life is in danger. Kavita Vinaker is an OBGYN and professor at UCLA.
I fear that, you know, in a field where repetition and volume are the main predictors of confidence and competence in any procedure, that competence and confidence will suffer.
Gaining that competence may become a bigger priority for students.
I think this is a huge concern for many, many medical students. And I think it's going to play heavily into how they apply to programs.
And where med students apply for residencies.
It's actually one of the first things I'm considering on where to apply.
Ian Peek is a fourth-year med student applying for residency. He's only looking in states like California, which has moved to protect abortion. This wasn't his original plan. He's always wanted to help patients in his home state of Oklahoma, where abortions are now illegal except to save the life of a pregnant person or if the pregnancy is the result of reported rape or incest.
It's very upsetting to know that I'm going to have to leave my home to pursue this or drop it altogether if I want to stay home. It's like that's the decision that you're kind of left with.
Years down the road, Peek hopes he can figure out some way to get abortion care to Oklahomans, even if he has to do it from afar. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
But I think it's a little bit more comrade based.
Different kind of comrade, people. Different kind of comrade. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 90 points today, 0.2%, finished at 31,990. The NASDAQ, rather, lost 51 points, 0.4%, 11,782. S&P 500 added 5, about a 10%, 39.66. Samantha Fields was telling us about training to work on wind turbines as that industry starts to ramp up offshore operations. So let's sail on over to some wind energy companies, shall we? Danish firm Vestas Wind deflated 2.6%. Canadian Northland Power lifted about a 10%. There's news that the grillmaker Weber's CEO is leaving the firm. Among other things, the company said its retail sales have been hurt by, come on, anything? Inflation. Weber burned off more than 12.5%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is going to be a big week for corporate earnings, too. Not just economic data this week, but corporate earnings as well. There's big tech coming, pharmaceuticals, also cars. GM comes out tomorrow. Ford is on Wednesday, then Apple on Thursday. Yes, that Apple. You might have missed it, but last month, the company announced a new and improved version of something called Apple CarPlay. Instead of just connecting with your car stereo over Bluetooth, the update would let Apple's operating system basically take over your dashboard. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains why that's a pretty big deal for Apple and for the car companies.
Apple wants to tell you how much gas you have, how fast you're going, basically be the operating system for your car. Dan Ives tracks Apple for Wedbush Securities.
Auto is a massive industry for Apple because it's just a further expansion of their ecosystem. Their goal is to be more and more entrenched in consumers' life.
And Apple is pretty good at sleek, intuitive software design. Car makers, though?
I'll be honest, some are really good at software implementation. Some are really bad at software implementation.
Thomas Hundle is a journalist with The Autopian. If you've ever felt you needed a PhD to understand your dashboard, you know what he's talking about. But Hundle does fear a future when the drive to pick up your kid from soccer practice is sponsored by Dick's Sporting Goods.
Everybody's looking to monetize these digital dashboards. Will you soon be seeing ads in your vehicle? Like, imagine how much that would suck.
To be clear, Hundle is talking about digital dashboards generally, not Apple's version. Apple famously makes more money off hardware than ads. But driver data is incredibly valuable, and car makers don't really want to hand it over to Silicon Valley, says Carla Bela with the Center for Automotive Research.
Driving behavior, usage behavior, meaning what are you using while you're in the car? What are you listening to?
All of that can be monetized, and the car companies would rather be the ones doing the monetizing. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Emmy nominations were out a couple of weeks ago, as I'm sure you saw or heard. And Abbott Elementary, a sitcom about teachers at a fictional elementary school in Philadelphia, which makes it, for us, a show about a workplace, right? They wound up with 7 noms, as I guess the Hollywood types like to say. Maybe less apparent is that Abbott's arguably part of a trend, a slew of comedies out in the past year or so, focusing on workers and their experiences, not a group that usually gets a whole lot of airtime. Roxana Haddadi wrote about that for Vulture. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Let's go to the headline of this piece, The Working Class Sitcom Strikes Back. Explain, would you?
Sure. Well, I think what I was trying to get across in this piece is that there is an array of sitcoms right now that sort of come from an anti-capitalist ideology. They're sort of poking fun at the idea of upward mobility, of the American dream being something that's attainable. And it's sort of a noticeable trend that I am really enjoying watching.
I mentioned Abbott Elementary up in the lead, which I don't think, and I think you agree with this, doesn't really fit in that category, but that's the one that gets all the press. So what are you, and the Emmy nominations, by the way, so what shows are you thinking about?
There are a couple on Peacock. They are Bust Down and Killing It. There is a show on HBO Max called Southside, and there is the FX on Hulu show Reservation Dogs. And I think what all of them do, which is a little bit different from Abbott Elementary, is Abbott Elementary is sort of taking the point of view of the system is flawed, but ultimately you can be like a force for good. Mm. I think these shows are a little more nihilistic about that entire concept, a little more cynical. And I think there's just a little bit of a subversive thrill of watching these shows and sort of feeling like, okay, I sort of recognize this feeling of being a little bit stuck,
but sort of cutting corners and trying to get ahead in a system that's sort of set up against you.
Do me a favor and do a little compare and contrast with the original, I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I think I'm right, the original working class situation comedy All in the Family, right? How do these compare?
I think the difference here is that All in the Family was very home-based. A lot of the conversations were about social issues. Yeah. They were on the couch. They were in the room with the piano, right? It was like a multi-generational discussion. These other shows sort of are taking place more actually at work. And they're more about the people who are alongside you working at these places that are 9-to-5s, but without a lot of opportunity to go elsewhere and do more. I mean, forgive me, but I think it's a little bit more comrade-based rather than family-based.
Yeah, no, I get it. That works.
Yeah,
that
so
works.
I do think they're doing something a little bit differently from like the Norman Lear established working place sitcom.
I imagine it also makes a huge difference who is both behind and in front of the camera. And on some of these shows, Abbott Elementary specifically, right, with Quinta Brunson creating and writing and EPing and all that jazz and then starring in it, but also Craig Robinson in Killing It, right? He's an executive producer and stars in it. It's people of color on both sides of the power dynamic, right?
Yes, absolutely. These are stories that are coming from within communities that we don't normally see on TV. So we're getting sort of different perspectives about the American dream. And you mentioned Killing It. Craig Robinson's character on that show has a very discernible arc where he starts out thinking, I have a business idea. I'm going to pitch it to investors. Surely people will realize my brilliance and I'll be able to achieve what has been promised to me. And then by the end, there's this very tangible, oh, every interaction I've had with someone who is rich has been terrible. Yeah. So what does that kind of tell you about what we've been promised?
So crystal ball this one for me, and let's caveat here that one can never truly divine the haphazard nature of whither goeth Hollywood and who gets to do a show. But are we going to get more of the Killing Its, do you think, or Reservation Dogs, or are we going to get more of the Ted Lassos, which is, while funny in its own way, a completely different beast?
Right. I mean, I think that we probably will get more of both just because there's so much TV right now.
Yeah.
And I unfortunately think with the economy as it is right now, there probably will be people who will feel sort of inspired by a $6 bagged salad to potentially, make their own TV show about that stressor.
Roxana Haddadi, she's a TV critic at Vulture, writing on, most recently anyway, sitcoms, the working class kind. Roxana, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Of course. Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, which, in all honesty, I am really tempted to repeat a couple of times the next couple of days until that GDP announcement comes out on Thursday, because all y'all are going to be hearing a whole lot about how the official definition of a recession is two consecutive quarters of a shrinking economy. Well, look, while two consecutive quarters of a shrinking economy can indicate a recession, the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research, remember them from the top of the program? They are the ones who get to decide, and their definition goes like this: a significant decline in economic activity that is spread across the economy and that lasts more than a couple of months. Now you know. All right, we're out of here, but of course, not without your moment of economic context. A quick little tidbit from a quarterly report that Tesla filed with the SEC today. Remember I told you the other day the company said it had sold off about 75% of its stash of Bitcoin? Turns out they lost $170 million actual dollars in the process. Our production team includes Anis Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Guillaume, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.